Yeah, I'm originally from Alabama.
Whereabouts?
Mobile.
How long? Well, you must have been there a long time because you still...
Well, I grew up there. Yeah. I left when I was about... Well, I left when I went off to college.
And I understand reading some of the publicity material, you went to Brooklyn College?
I did go to Brooklyn College, yeah.
Was that your primary goal, Brooklyn College?
Oh, no. Yeah. I went to Brooklyn College because I ended up in New York just by happenstance, and then Brooklyn College was cheap, so that's why I went there.
How did you end up in New York?
Well, I was, that was the 60s, or I guess it was actually the 70s, but it's the period we call the 60s, and I was a roamer, and I was just roaming around the country, and I thought I'd try New York, so I came here just because I was kind of a lost soul at the time. And when I decided to go to Brooklyn College, it was really because I decided to study music.
This was right after high school?
Oh, no. There were intervening years of lostness there, where I went out to California and became a hippie and did all that sort of thing.
Lostness, intervening years of lostness.
Well, I mean, I was a lost soul, you know. I was searching like many young people at that time.
Yeah, post-adolescence is not the easiest period in our lives, is it? It's almost as bad as adolescence itself, only you're older.
Well, you know, I mean, it's the kind of period I always reflect on and think I wish I had known then what I know now.
Oh, God, we all do. Well, I admire you because when I got out of college, I took a job in a radio television station in West Virginia, a job that lasted perhaps less than a year. And I was faced, I had about $500 in a Volkswagen, and I was faced with the prospect of either finding another job or maybe going around the country. I thought, shit, I've always wanted to see Colorado and Montana.
Right.
Unfortunately, I came from a WASPy type family with a heavy work ethic, and I was afraid of what my father would say if he saw that I would be bumming around the country in this Volkswagen, so I found another job. So I missed what you have.
Well, I mean, I came from that kind of family, too. It's just that it was the thing to do in that day, to completely reject everything that you could possibly reject, and so knowing that my father would feel exactly the same way, you know, I rejected that. We went across the country in the middle of winter. You know, it was just completely crazy.
You had traveling companions?
I had one traveling companion, yes, a girlfriend I was traveling with at the time.
What was it like being a hippie?
Well, it was a lot like you might imagine. You know, I mean, it was, I had long hair and had the same pair of jeans that I wore every day and the same pair of I think I had a shirt that was a long underwear shirt that I wore every day. It was kind of like a uniform. And I lived in a house out in California with 13 other people. And we had a sort of communal arrangement. And we did drugs. And we protested against the war. And most of us had to, at least those of us who were male, had to, you know, keep one foot in a school somewhere to keep from being drafted into the army. And you know, it was a very counterculture kind of lifestyle.
Well, you really cleaned up your act. I mean, you're...
I've tried. I've worked very hard to...
You have an adult uniform on now, with a striped shirt and tie, and a job as a college professor, and the music room, of course, is a very traditional novel in many respects. It's not, certainly not a hippie style, not a Ken Casey type of a book at all, is it?
No, it's not. No, I would think of it as traditional also.
But your parents did not disown you?
No, I mean, somehow. I think I disowned them. And they were, at least from a distance, I think, really pretty loyal to me.
But during this period, were you doing any writing? Or your goal, apparently, because you mentioned going to New York, was that of becoming a musician?
I think that when I was a freshman in college, I went to a liberal arts school in the South just for the first year. And at that time, I entertained the notion of being a writer, and I wrote one short story, and I sent it to the Atlantic Monthly. And I declared there that if they didn't take it, then I was going to give up the idea of being a writer. And, of course, they didn't take it, so I gave up the idea of being a writer. And after that, you know, I started getting into the scene of, you know, everything that was happening in those days. It was a very, it was a period of a lot of turmoil. I was in Memphis the year that Martin Luther King was was killed, and then subsequently went to California, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. I mean, I had sort of an artistic temperament, I think, and I always thought of, I never, for example, I never thought of being a civil engineer or anything like that, but I studied art for a while in school, and then I think I dropped out 3 or 4 times. I wasn't a very good student. I couldn't, I think studies was just required more discipline than I had, especially during that period when discipline wasn't really the thing.
Well, somehow during this period, you came to New York and enrolled at Brooklyn College, and were you going to play cello or what? What was it that you saw?
No, I majored in composition. Uh-huh. I was going to be a composer. I was going to be a composer of art music, and I composed a lot of very esoteric-sounding pieces for things like live clarinet and pre-recorded clarinet, and explored in with different producing different sounds out of traditional instruments. And after a while, I just decided that what I was doing was in fact esoteric, and that even if I became very successful at it, I felt that it was something that would interest maybe an audience of about 100 people. And I decided to give up music and try something else, which, after some thought, I decided would be writing.
Well, I'm not so much. I'm not so sure that's much different from writing, because there are many authors today who write stories that are read by 100 people or less.
Well, that's true. That's true. Fortunately, the music room, I think, was reached more than 100 people.
Yeah, I'm not talking about the music room. I'm talking about the writers who are publishing not in the Atlantic Monthly, but in these myriad little magazines sometimes.
No, that's
they have
right.
a circulation of 100 or 500.
That's right.
Tiny. Sometimes they come out sporadically. But it seems to be the only market for short stories today, really.
I think all those people hope to reach a larger audience eventually, though. I mean, I don't think anyone actually thinks and aspires to having a long-lasting career in the literary journals.
Well, that's true, but someone who has an artistic bent wants to be a writer, has to place his or her stories somewhere.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I can tell you from personal experience, it's not easy having those stories placed in the small magazines. They only publish a couple of stories per issue.
I know.
They're very selective, and the editors usually have their own mind bent.
Yeah. So. And they take anywhere from 6 months to a year and a half to reply to a manuscript that's sent in, and they may receive as much as 2,000 manuscripts for 4 stories that they're going to publish in a year. So yeah, it's a terrible thing, I think, for writers. It's hard to keep your morale up, I think, during that period.
Yeah, I was talking to a writer, and I'm sure you've read some of the short stories. Rick Bass, have you read him?
Uh-huh.
Have you read him?
Well, I actually have not read him, but I
he has
know
a new
the
book just came out. It's a nonfiction book called Winter, about uh-huh. his first winter in the mountains of Montana. Uh-huh. But he was sitting right where you're sitting, and he was saying that he started publishing short stories. He got some in the New Yorker finally, but he said he had tried to sell more than 1,000 stories, or he had more than 1,000 rejections, is the way he put it, more than 1,000 rejections before he sold his first short story to a small magazine.
That's a lot of rejections.
Now, when you think about it, 1,000 rejections, and this goes on for years, he said. It went on for years and years and years, but he never gave up. He just did it.
Well, when people come to me and ask, you know, advice, aspiring writers ask advice, I just always say that persistence is at least half the battle. I mean, I think you have to have some talent, and you certainly have to go and learn as much about the craft as you can. But hanging in there and being having whatever it takes to persist in the face of something like 1,000 rejection slips, I think is very important to a writer.
It's kind of boring to package those stories, put the postage on the envelope, and mailing it out again.
I hated it. One of my least favorite parts about it was going to the post office, because, you know, when you have to include a return envelope, and the return envelope has to have real stamps on it, right? It can't be metered. And you also have to have them weigh it twice in case it's not exactly the same weight coming back as going, and having to stand up at the grill and go through this explanation with the person behind the counter every time was always a source of humiliation to me for some reason.
Oh, well, there's a better way of doing it, I found.
Get somebody else to do it.
No, right? No. What writers are doing now, they don't want the stories back. You know, they can photocopy them, or if they have printers with computers, all they do is put in a little envelope for a return and tell them to keep the story, throw it out.
Yeah,
that way they
don't
have to deal with the return postage. It's too expensive for most people, and it's easier just to have it photocopied, especially if you work in an office at night.
Right.
it's very, very inexpensive. Well, let's go back a little bit. I was kind of trying to take you in chronology a little bit to work up to the music room. You left Brooklyn College. You were not. Oh, I did see something in the publicity material that you had stage fright a little bit. Did you actually perform music?
Well, no. I mean, I only performed as a part of what you do when you're in a music education. We had repertoire class, and I would have to perform for the other people at the school. And I always had terrible nerves when it came time to perform. My instrument was the piano.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned this in passing to a journalist at the New York Times Book Review when they were doing the, you know how they do the little box that goes with the review?
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing I knew, there was a headline that said, "We owe this book to stage fright." So in some way, that whole thing has been built up a little bit bigger by the media than it truly was. But if you were to ask me now to play the piano, I would still have the same problem.
You get very self-conscious.
Yeah. I mean, now, for example, I have given and I continue to give lots of public readings, and I have what I would think are normal nerves that anybody would have before addressing a group of people, but I wouldn't call it stage fright by any means.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but reading is a lot easier than performing.
Yes, fortunately.
I know exactly what you feel, because I taught myself to play the banjo a little bit, the five-string banjo, and somebody along the line at a dinner party would say, "Don, get out your banjo." And I really wouldn't want to do it, but I'd get it out, you know, and I would be very conscious of all these eyes waiting for me to perform, and I would literally freeze up. I just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
I can see if this is what happened to you, I can understand it.
No, it was maddening, because, you know, there would be people who I knew did not play as well as I did, and because they didn't have this particular thing, they'd get up and be able to play, and then I would go up there and I would be so nervous that I wouldn't be able to play the piece.
But I get on the radio and fake it, because I can always read. You know, right. I know how to read, so I can fake it. It's not like... Well, anyway, what happened after Brooklyn College? That didn't work out for you. What happened next?
Well, eventually, I decided that I wanted to try my hand at writing. And one of the things I was thinking about really was the fact that it was something that I could do in a room alone, that, you know, without an audience. And I sold, eventually, I inherited a piece of land that I sold, and I had a little money, and I went up and
where was this?
I'm sorry?
Where was this?
The land?
Mm-hmm.
It was down south.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, a family inheritance.
Right.
And I took a place up in the Poconos, and I decided I was going to just go up there and hole up for a winter, or for a whole, actually, I think it was longer than that, maybe a whole year, and teach myself to write. And I went up there and I read and I wrote, and that's all I did the whole time. There was a ski area close by, and I'd go skiing during the day. And eventually I applied to graduate school and went to Goddard College and got an MFA in writing from Goddard College. And while I was still enrolled there, I published my first story in The New Yorker. And
that was a real coup, wasn't it?
It was a coup, and it was very...
Story in The New Yorker.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't the first story I'd written, but it was the first story I'd published,
mm-hmm.
and it was in The New Yorker, and I think I got a lot of mileage out of that. You know, I think it was instrumental in my getting a fellowship to Stanford afterwards. And
was that story one of the components of the music room?
No, not at all. It was a story called Lullaby, and it was published in 1980, and it was quite a short little story about a woman who was falling asleep in public as reaction to heartbreak that she felt over the breakup of her marriage.
So you went out to Stanford. That has a terrific reputation, doesn't it?
Stanford?
Yeah, Wallace Stegner formed that writer's group there.
Yeah.
Robert Stone.
There are a lot of good people that came out of Stanford.
And Casey, didn't he teach there?
Yes. Yeah. Well, they had, for a long time, they had one of the most, the Stegner Fellowship was a fellowship that went to writers and at a time when there weren't so many as there are now. And it was always one of the best, and you got the most money. And I had never heard of it. And a friend of mine said, why don't you apply for the Stegner? And I applied, and much to my complete shock, I got it. So that came very close on the heels after graduating from Goddard when, there again I had another degree and I didn't know what I was going to do with it. And so it kind of filled the gap for me. And then after the fellowship year, I was hired to teach there for a few years.
What was the fellowship helpful to you, do you think?
In terms of the writing itself, I don't think it was very helpful to me in terms of the writing itself because I didn't end up writing very much. It was a workshop, was what it was. The Stegner Fellows at Stanford attend the graduate workshop at Stanford, and for me, it was a little bit like being in limbo out there because, as a Stegner Fellow, because you weren't a graduate student, so you weren't quite a student, but you didn't have the status of faculty either. So it was a kind of a little bit of a no man's land, that position. But I met people there who, I met Alice Adams there, who was guest teaching, who is now a close friend and godmother to my daughter.
Oh. And I've interviewed Alice at least three or four times, and she was just here 2 weeks ago.
Oh, yeah, I know.
There's a wonderful new book out.
Title Caroline's Daughter.
That's right, Caroline's Daughter.
Yeah, it is good.
Beautifully, beautifully done. I love the way she writes.
Very simple,
present tense book, and she really captured the feeling of San Francisco in this last book.
Yeah.
Well, at some point you began working on the music room. Tell me how this book came about.
Well, I've been trying to write a novel for a long time. The idea was that was to get my toes wet as a writer by writing short stories, but then 10 years later I was still writing nothing but short stories, and I just couldn't figure out how anybody wrote anything as long as a novel. I didn't know how you extended a story to the length of a novel.
They didn't tell you at Goddard?
No, they didn't have a recipe at Goddard or at Stanford for that. I had a few false starts, where I try to get a novel started, and I'd end up with 40 or 50 pages that were really very tight and full of integrity and self-referential and well-composed and economical, but there was nowhere to go with it. And so I decided that I just plain didn't like the novel, and I wasn't going to try to write one for a long time. But that was really sour grapes because, of course, I really did want to write a novel. And I think for me it was about concept. It was coming up with an idea that was a novelistic idea as opposed to the kind of idea that would be suitable for a story. And it really came from mysteries, from murder mysteries, which I don't read, but my wife reads. And we would sometimes go on vacation and read murder mysteries aloud to each other, and particularly Dorothy Sayers, who I think is one of the best writers, and I just sort of connected with something that's very obvious about mysteries, which is that they get extended through a central idea, the whodunit. And I decided I'd write a novel that had a central question at its heart. And and then, I don't know, somewhere along the line I came up with the central question being that this person's brother had killed himself, and the living brother would set off on a quest to try to figure out why he did it. Mm. And that led to the music room.
There's another young relative, well, I guess he's not that young, I guess he's perhaps your age, named Bob Shikochis.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know his stuff or not. He won the American Book Award for his for a collection of short stories he wrote a few years ago. He's trying to write a novel. That's what he's done. I mean, he's written short stories, which he handles beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to write a short story, or trying to write a novel, he was telling me, it was like being in a cave, a dark cave, trying to get out. He was having all sorts of problems with it. And he's been working on a novel now for a couple of years. I don't know how far he's gotten. He could do the short story pretty well because he could see the end of it.
Yeah.
But he was felt trapped in this cave.
Yeah. Well,
probably a good analogy.
Yeah. Well, I just think that in some ways it may in fact be, it may not be an asset to be a good short story writer when it comes time to write a novel. Because so many of your instincts and so many of the things that you've, the techniques that you've mastered in order to become a good short story writer are not going to really serve you very well in the novel. Because, as a form, the short story is biting off something very small and chewing it in an interesting way. And it turns on a kind of central event often that implies most of what led up to it and implies what's going to follow from it. And in a novel, you're going to undertake the whole business of giving all the history and filling in all the gaps. And I just think that it sort of goes against some of those instincts of a short story writer.
Well, right up until almost the end of his life, Raymond Carver had been under a great deal of pressure to write a novel. And he was telling, I also interviewed him several times, he was telling me that finally he said, I'm going to do it. I'm going to start the novel. Every day he would start the novel. At the end of the day he'd have a page, which was a good poem, he said. So I said, well, this is a poem. So he would put that aside. The next day he would start a novel again, and it turned out to be a poem. And this happened, he said, day after day after day. And at the end of a year, he had a stack of pages that became a book of poetry called, I believe it was called Aquamarine, which I think may have been his last book of poems. And he never did publish a novel.
Well, I think he didn't have the temperament to be a novelist. And I just think that's probably true for a lot of people and a lot of very fine writers. And it's a difficult thing to escape that pressure to write a novel because everybody expects you to write a novel.
Well, Malcolm Bossy, who is probably best known for his novel The Warlord, was saying that you don't have to be the smartest guy in the world to write a novel, but you have to have bulldog determination and just stick at it day after day after day until it's finished.
Yeah, Flannery O'Connor used to say that writing stories was better suited to people who like to get the pain over in a hurry.
Well, let's go back to the music room, and it is kind of a detective story, one that is not fully resolved at the end, isn't that true? We don't really
the detective part of the
because we don't really have a complete understanding as to Perry's suicide.
Yeah, well, it's one of the premises of the book. I think that was something I came to. It was a perception that seemed to be true. It seemed to me, without naming names here, it seemed to me that I had encountered in fiction too many instances where a person's suicide was explained by some specific dark secret or repressed event from the past or something like that, so that we search for the answer and then we discover something about the character who killed himself and we say, oh, that's why he killed himself. You know, it was because of this terrible traumatic event that happened on November 13th when he was 5 years old. And that always seemed unconvincing to me. It seemed much more a device of fiction than it did of real life. It seemed to me much truer that people who decided to take their own lives made that decision out of a very complicated combination of things that went on in their past and not because of one specific event. And so one of the premises of the book is that this narrator sets off on this quest to find that kind of answer, the kind that I was talking about, but ends up seeing that, in fact, it was everything that went on in their upbringing and that contributed to Perry's self-destruction.
Yeah, I'm
not a single thing.
I think you're absolutely right, and I'm rather amused at the naivety of some reporters, including myself, who after a suicide are told by the police, well, she didn't leave a note, so we don't know why she did it.
Right.
Well, the fact is, we know why she did it. She did it, or he did it, because he or she was terribly, terribly depressed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about that kind of, a relatively young person like Perry, not an old person dying in agony of cancer, for example. I mean, I can understand why a person like that might want to terminate his or her life. But a young person who, well, I remember just a few years ago, I was with a volunteer group. We had a lawyer, and we met on a regular basis to plan fairs and all this sort of thing. And one day, I woke up in the morning, I picked up the newspaper, and I saw that she was an adjunct professor at Hunter. Huh. She had taken a chair, she'd gone to a high floor, smashed the window, and jumped out to her death.
Huh.
And I had just seen her a couple of days before. We didn't talk, she didn't seem depressed.
Huh.
We had no idea, and there again, police said she left no note. But she had to be depressed over a million different things in her life that may have gone back years, or, I mean, how do you sort one's depression, I wonder?
Well, see, the other thing that I was thinking about when I was writing this novel is that there you might think of the self-destructive tendency as a kind of psychological disease, and that it's a disease that gets passed on from one generation to the next. And often, in families that have this self-destructive disease, we find substance abuse or other kinds of addictions present. And so, even though these parents in this story are both raging alcoholics throughout their kids' childhood, and the child who killed himself did not become an alcoholic, it's the supposition of the book that there's something about the self-destructive disease that gets passed on to the child, even if it takes a different form in the next generation.
Yeah, that was my next question, alcoholism, and it plays a terrific role in this book, not only with the mother and the father in the book, but the grandfather as well, who pilots a plane apparently in an alcoholic state.
That was deliberate, again, to sort of emphasize my point that it's a generational disease that gets passed on.
And Marty, is that...
The narrator is Marty.
Yeah. Marty, yeah. And he, I'm not sure he's a full-fledged alcoholic, but he certainly is a heavy drinker.
Yeah, he's living an alcoholic life.
Well, this book certainly came out to marvelous reviews. It was last year, right? Last year?
Mm-hmm. Last spring.
How did this make you feel? I mean, it must be a very special feeling to say, look, here is something I created, my child, and it's here. I'm holding it in my hands, and here I'm giving it to the world. And this could either be a terrible experience or a bad or a terrific experience. I have a feeling in your case it was a good one.
It made me feel very, very surprised. I, certainly didn't expect it to be as successful as it was, and I'm sure that I wasn't the only one who was surprised. Because the perception of the book in the early days was that it was well written, and that it was a literary novel, and it would probably get some critical attention, but. More than once I heard the phrase, well, this is not a book that's going to make anybody rich. And then it became a bestseller. And I think that surprised a lot of people.
But it was not your real intention to become rich on the book anyway, was it?
Well, no.
As an artist,
not.
I mean, artists aren't expected
no.
to get rich.
No, but it made me a lot more money than I ever dreamed of.
Well, you had a movie deal that probably did
better
than
the biggest,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've talked to a lot of writers who love those movie options.
Oh, they're
even
great.
If it's never made into a movie,
they're great. Just keep renewing it year after year after year.
Well, is this going to be the movie? Is it going to be a fait accompli at some point?
Well, that's impossible to predict. There are a lot of hurdles to get over in the making of a movie, and I think that they can fall apart at any point in the process. But Goober and Peters is the company that bought it, and they do seem very serious about it, and they seem to really love the book. They've hired somebody they consider to be one of the best in the business. A man by the name of Richard Friedenberg is writing the screenplay. He's apparently finished one draft of the screenplay and is soon to finish a second draft. And so apparently the script is in its final stages. And again, without naming names, Apparently there are some people in the industry who have expressed interest in getting first dibs on the screenplay. So I'm very hopeful that they'll make it, because I think it'll be a lot of fun.
You think it's going to be a lot of fun, but it's in effect taking your creation out of your hands and giving it to someone else to dramatize.
Oh, yeah, it's already happened. I mean, I sort of accept that, and when I say it'll be a lot of fun, is I think it'll be a lot of fun to get dressed up and go to an opening and see my name come up on the screen.
If they do it right.
Well, even if they don't,
well, they did
right,
the Tom Wolfe's movie, a book.
Was he very upset?
I don't know. probably got a lot of money for it, but the Bonfires of the Vanities was just creamed by
the critics. I just think you have to, you know, the only way to avoid that is to make the movie yourself. And I don't mean even write the screenplay yourself. You have to write the screenplay, direct it, and produce it. I mean, it's just, I think going in, you have to get very clear about the fact that if you're going to sell the rights to your book, to the movies, they're going to do whatever they do with it. And you have to be able to let go of any artistic investments you have in it. And that's what I have tried to do, and that's what I'll continue. I mean, I think probably if they make it and it's a terrible movie, I'll probably be disappointed. But I feel very clear about the fact that my book is my book, and the movie is something completely different.
Well, I think you have a healthy attitude. Sue Miller, who wrote The Good Mother, as far as I know to this point, has not seen that movie.
She went to see it?
She said, last time I talked to her when she had a new novel for the end of last year, she said she has absolutely refused to go see it. And the movie, I saw the movie with Diane Keaton. It was. I thought it was extremely well done. But she said the movie wasn't hers, and she wanted to continue living the lives of her characters. She felt very strongly about it and just couldn't bear to go see the movie. Me, I'd be like you. If I had a book that had been turned into a film, I would just have to go see it.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I don't know what she calls upon, to be able to repress the curiosity.
I don't either.
There.
Well, the music room really changed your life then, didn't it?
Well, it changed my life in material ways. You know, I mean, we have more money now than we've ever had, and I feel that what I do in the future will command an automatic kind of attention, at least. Not necessarily success, but in other words, it'll get read by significant people in the business and so on and so forth. In other words, it's a foot in the door.
Have your parents said, now that you have this money, does that mean you don't have to work for a living, or you can just write books?
Oh, everybody thinks that. Everybody thinks that. I was recently at dinner where I said something about something that had been on the Phil Donahue show, and asked the person who is in has a Wall Street job of some kind. Did you happen to see this program that was on some Wall Street subject? And she said, well, no. I work for a living. And it was, and I said, well, I work too. It's just that I'm usually done by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. People really don't think that writers are workers.
Oh, it's incredible. I'm an amateur writer myself. And on my vacations, I'll go in there and shut my door and sit at my word processor and start to write, and my wife thinks nothing. Bang, 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 or, you know, calling me and so forth. And I said, look, I'm trying to write. I'm trying. She doesn't understand it. She's never been able to conceptualize that. She thinks I'm playing with the computer.
Right.
Or when I had the typewriter, and my kid would start to bother me, living in an L-shaped Manhattan apartment, sitting there, dining room table, on this old Smith Corona portable typewriter, and my kid would come over and say, Daddy, Daddy, and my wife would say, don't bother Daddy while he's typing. And this would infuriate me. I'd say, I am not typing. I am writing. I am writing.
Yeah.
But the distinction, when I got the computer, then I was playing computer games. You know, don't bother Daddy while he's playing with his computer.
Right. I think part of that attitude comes from the fact that we all have language, and we all know how to write in English, if English is our language. And so people, I mean, what you hear all the time is that, you know, I've always wanted to write a book, but I've never been able to find the time to sit down. And the implication of that remark is that we serious writers have have just been frivolous enough to indulge ourselves, you know, in this process of sitting down. But sitting down is really the hard part. And once you've indulged yourself to sit down, then of course anybody can write.
Dennis, they're never going to do it, ever. And if they did find the time, they probably won't do it. It takes discipline and work and experience. And you put in spite of your degrees from Goddard and Stanford, you put in your own time in the Poconos. And it's in a way, writing is a self-taught profession, and it takes an enormous amount of discipline to be able to do it.
It takes a lot of practice is what it takes.
In practice, too. Yeah. You can become experienced, though, can't you? I mean, it's like many other things. You learn to be good. And you learn tricks and how to cut corners.
I think of it as a foreign language. You know, that if you really want to become fluent in a foreign language, what you do is you go to the country where they speak that language and you immerse yourself in it so that you're hearing it all the time. And I think that's the way that you learn to write, too, is that you have to immerse yourself in it and just do it every day as much as possible.
Joyce Carol Oates calls it creating a giant puzzle. A puzzle of your own making and putting all the pieces together. I thought that was also a very good analogy.
Yeah.
Well, Dennis McFarland, I'm delighted that The Music Room is out in paperback. I hope that at some point, in addition to the Avon trade, there'll be a mass market paperback, too. That will be helpful for people who travel in bus stations and airports and things like that. Music Room is an absolutely beautiful book, and I enjoyed reading it when it first came out, and I'm delighted to wish I'd talked to you then, but I'm glad I was able to catch up a little bit and talk to you now. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.